The Athletic.
I hope anybody's not stupid enough to write us off.
It's Two Stars time. This is the weekly Nottingham Forest podcast from The Athletic. On this episode, it's fucking hell for Forest as Norwich show why they're in a different league. The run of rough fixtures continues as the Reds head to West London. There's own goals galore, and we'll ask, did they really play for Forest? Available for free wherever you get your podcasts and ad-free on The Athletic. This is Two Stars. Hello, listener. Nice to have your company again. It's Matt here alongside The Athletic's Forest correspondent, Paul Taylor. Hi, Paul.
Good morning to you, sir.
And also with us, as always, the big show himself, Nick Miller.
The big show.
Even I understand that one.
Yeah, well, the nice thing about that one is that could conceivably be just a general nickname. All right, big man, big dog, big show. Yeah, that'll do. But I presume it is that is a wrestler, I assume.
Yeah, he's just left WWE after 20 years to join AEW. So he has to actually lose the moniker The Big Show now, because that is a trademarked name. So, and his real name's Paul White, so it's not quite as...
Well, can he be the medium show? The slightly larger than the normal show?
The large show, yeah. The large.
There's a segue here about Forest being the shit show, isn't there? But I should probably not make that and just move on. We are recording in the aftermath of Forest's defeat against Norwich at the City Ground on Wednesday night. We'll discuss that further after a brief interlude designed to break up the monotony of three blokes talking. Forest nil, Norwich 2 then, and from the sounds of it, Forest were lucky to get the nil. Norwich had 22 shots to Forest 5, the Reds mustering just one effort on target all night, and the Canaries flying on cruise control from the moment ex-Reds loanee Kieran Dowell added to Timu Pukki's early opener. Before we get to the game, can we offer David some comfort? He's tweeted the show to ask, is it too soon to use the term season unravelling? Injuries, bizarre team selections, absolutely no attacking threat, players criticising others in interviews, and the most passive manager ever. Nick, can you offer any kind of comfort?
I said last night that this podcast was just going to be me sighing deeply for about half an hour, so I'll leave it at that big sigh just there. Unraveling, I'm not sure. While most of the things that he said there are correct, we all knew that this was going to be a bad run. When you kind of knew that the chances are Forest weren't going to get many points from this run of games. So in that respect, it isn't entirely unexpected. As we've kind of said before, Forest probably got too much not to really get sucked into a proper kind of relegation scrap. But it is in the kind of aftermath of such a sort of comprehensive 2-0, you know, one of the more comprehensive 2-0 defeats you'll ever see. And it was more the kind of emphasis of how far away Forest are from the kind of top teams in the division at the moment. It is difficult to get to be too kind of optimistic about things. Unraveling, I'm not sure. I don't think we're quite in sort of cracked badge territory yet. There needs to be some kind of bust up before that happens. But it's certainly a humbling experience, the game against Norwich.
Not just the game against Norwich, Paul, but actually, obviously, results dictate mood among supporters, but also how those results come about. So if Forest had got the late equaliser against Reading rather than the other way around, and say on Wednesday night had conceded after half an hour and then another one deep into stoppage time, it would look different, wouldn't it? But the fact that Norwich had the game won after 13 minutes and Reading were well worth at least a point, that just changes things in terms of supporters' expectations and outlook.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd say two things, really. The first thing is that this Norwich game on its own was always going to be a barometer for how far away Forest are from competing with the very best in the division, because Norwich are the best in the division by some distance. They're head and shoulders above everybody else. Chris Hughton said last night that they're perhaps even challengers for being the best championship side ever, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, certainly on the current run that they're on. And you wanted to see Forest go toe-to-toe with them and find out how far they were from being able to compete at that level. And the answer was a long way. It was, you know, to be blunt, the gap is quite big. But I don't know realistically what else we were expecting. Had Forest won the game 1-0, had they somehow ground out a victory, I think most people, to be honest, would have been, it would have been a surprise result. They never looked like getting that. But their problems aren't anything new. Nothing that we saw last night was anything that we weren't aware of before. They're very solid defensively. They're well organised. They're disciplined. They give very little away. But they're in the middle of a goal drought. They can't score goals. Once Norwich went 2-0 up, you realised that Forest, they had a mountain to climb. I hate that cliche, but it really was that bad. They haven't scored two goals in the space of a game in 8 previous fixtures. So to do so against Norwich felt very, very unlikely. They did create 1 or 2 chances. Ryan Yates had his customary missed header, bless him. You know, Lewis Grabban had his usual missed one-on-one, which he didn't miss very often last season, but this season seems to be underpinning his entire campaign. It was all very predictable and all further evidence of the problems that Chris Hughton has to solve if they are ever to have any hope of competing with teams like Norwich. They have to find a way to score goals. They have to find a way to convert their chances. They have to find a way to not have to be in a blind panic whenever the opposition score, knowing that they're unlikely to get back into it. That's the only answer to it. Nothing was new last night. Forest went up against one of the best teams in the division, and if I'm entirely honest, what you expected was what unfolded. There's a lot of work to do.
We've spoken about the lack of goals a lot in recent weeks, Nick. What seems different about this game in particular, and something you pointed out, was the game plan in terms of how passive it was. Here's Barry, who's tweeted us to say, "I've never seen an opposition have it so easy. They conserved energy for 60 minutes. It was embarrassing." It was almost like both sides kind of accepted it at the point that it got to 2-0. Is that a silly thing to say?
I'm sure no one at Forest would kind of admit to accepting the 2-0 defeat, and obviously make attacking substitutions in the second half. But yeah, I mean, the concern was that about the game last night was, you know, Chris Hughton's has made Forest generally very solid and, you know, defensively well organised, but that didn't seem to be the case, certainly in the opening stages last night. Forest were, you know, as we've said, incredibly passive. They sat back to defend, but didn't defend very well. They were just somehow managed to sit deep and try and defend, but also managed to be incredibly open. I think, you know, Norwich would have been, I think, probably quite disappointed to only score those 2 goals in the first 20 minutes or so. The attitude was almost, well, you know, we'll take a defeat, but we'll try not to take a beating. And I don't know, while we did all expect it, that's not a kind of a particularly inspiring game plan to take. I mean, you know, should also caveat this by saying I think Hughton is generally speaking doing exactly the right things, and he's what Forest need at the moment. And if the kind of the pattern of his career history continues at Forest, then this is the kind of season we're expecting. Consolidation, hopefully a bit more next season. But it was the fact that there was sort of seemingly, in the initial stages at least, I know things improved a little bit after halftime, no real ambition to do anything other than limit damage, which when you can see 2 goals in the first 13 minutes, the plan didn't quite work.
I don't think it's anybody being passive or defensive-minded. I just think with Norwich, you have a very straight choice. They're so slick in their passing, so play with urgency and momentum and purpose that you've got a choice. You either try and press them really hard and get in their faces and they pass around you, or you sit off a little bit and try and stifle them. And Forest didn't do either. They were caught between pillar and post. They didn't really press, and they didn't defend effectively either. I don't think somebody tweeted before the game that Forest had picked a team to lose, which just seemed bizarre to me. And I don't see it as being a problem with attitude or mentality, or that Forest went out thinking, oh, defeat will be fine as long as it's not too heavy. I just don't know how you do things against a team like Norwich. Tactically, you've got to pick a perfect plan and stick to it. And I don't think Forest did that. I think they were caught between two posts last night and didn't quite do either. And for the first 20 minutes, as a result of that, they were torn apart. By being perhaps cautious or uncertain that they were caught out. But I don't think it was any, you know, element of them being passive or lacking aggression. It was, it was bad, but not perhaps in that way.
Let's talk about some players who did and didn't play. First, a couple who did. Tyler Blackett, I think, was a bit of a surprise, Nick. But as Paul points out, you know, Forrest have got three capable left backs, and he's certainly one of those. He's got plenty of Championship experience. The other one was Luke Freeman over Alex Mighton, which seems to be a consistent thing, and that's the kind of thing I think which supporters are railing against a little bit. Part of that, obviously, is because Mighton's an academy product, but also because Freeman hasn't really offered much so far.
Yeah, I try not to kind of get involved in the sort of pylons about the kind of coalesce around certain players, which, you know, Paul, I imagine Paul is much more familiar with whenever, if ever yeah. he says anything positive about a player who's, you know, on the naughty list for whatever reason. But I don't, I was excited about Freeman signing in the summer, but as far in the games that I've watched anyway, and, you know, Paul may be able to contradict this because he watches Forest a lot more closely than I do, but he has offered virtually nothing or not, certainly not the kind of what we thought he might when he signed. The caveats are, of course, that he was injured for a lot of the season, and he has been playing kind of probably out of position. His best position is probably in the middle. He's been playing on the flank, but I don't necessarily see that as a case for keeping him in the team. I think he's now kind of recovered from his injury and has been playing enough football for the fitness question to not be quite so much of an excuse. And, you know, again, last night, I you know, it's harsh to pick anyone out as being particularly bad, particularly from the first half against Norwich. But I don't get it. I don't understand why, particularly when Lolly and Knockart were unavailable, why Alex Mighton wasn't given more of a chance when we knew that counter-attacks were probably going to be the kind of best chance of actually doing anything for long spells last night. So it would have made much more sense to play Alex Mighton on the wing than Freeman. But I without wishing to group myself into the angry people in Paul's Twitter mentions, I don't get it with Freeman. I don't get why he keeps being picked.
It's strange you say that, because last night, with perfect timing, I chose the moment of the pre-match Q&A on the Athletic website to defend Freeman and say, you know, look, he's been a good player in previous times. Every time he's played against Forest for other clubs, he's been brilliant. He's bound to come good at some point. He's not done it so far, but you know, keep the faith and hopefully he'll start to show what he can do. And then, you know, I actually would pick him out as being one of the worst performers last night. He was poor, but it is tough. You know, how does a player, another player, and it's not the first one, who's previously good at his other clubs, come to Forest and suddenly become pants? I know the injury was a major factor, but it just seems to be a tradition that players come to Forest and lose any thread of ability that they previously had overnight. It's a strange one. You know, there's still a few games left. Hopefully he'll show what he can do. I suspect Chris Hughton won't give up on him. But yeah, I completely agree with most of what Nick said. It would be great to see Alex Mighton given a chance, not just through sentiment because he's one of Forest's own, if you like, but because he's a very good young player. And you imagine in the next sort of 9 or 10, 8 or 9 games, there's an opportunity there to blood somebody who's still only 18 and give him an opportunity on the side to grow and develop. And it would be a shame to waste that.
Lastly, on the Norwich game, this is a recurring theme from last week. Here's Jordan asking, what do we think of the players' reaction after the game? For me, they seem like they expected to be defeated and didn't seem bothered. But Lyle Taylor looked really pissed off. Is there something in that? Does he want to go, or is he annoyed with others? He's kind of on his own island, I think, isn't he, Lyle Taylor? It would probably be fair to say. But is this just people looking for something that isn't there? I mean, they didn't have cigars and party hats on at the end of the game, presumably, Paul.
No, they didn't. It's a strange one. You know, when you speak to the players, they all talk about there not being any cliques or any, you know, division in the dressing room and how everyone's together. But then you look at in the stand during the game last night, and there were little groups who are not, the players that weren't involved were all sat in the stand, and they're all sat in different groups. Perhaps I'm reading too much into it, but you do wonder how much togetherness there is there. You know, Joe Worrall is always very straight talking. He's always very honest. He's always very blunt. And after the game the other weekend at Watford, he delivered a very straight talking appraisal of how he thought the rest of the squad and himself included could be a little bit more brave. I mean, we spoke about that a lot already, but I wonder how that does go down in a dressing room. That do people sit there and look at themselves in the mirror and say, yeah, I'm not doing my job, he's right? Or do they say, he's talking bollocks, he can do one? You know, what is the reaction to a speech like that? Does every player react well to it, or has it caused problems in the dressing room? I don't know.
Not to labour the point, Nick, but this is a problem inherent with having a lot of loan players and having a reputation as a club that is transitionary in nature, in that you come and stay for a season, maybe two if you're lucky, and then you look to try and go somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's we've talked about this before on the podcast as well. It's just very, from a supporter's perspective, it's very difficult to get excited about players who you suspect aren't going to be there next season. And I imagine that's kind of amplified within the dressing room, not just with the individual players themselves, because there's always a temptation to think that, you know, the players will say, well, it doesn't really matter if if this team I'm playing for currently aren't any good, because I'm going to be somewhere else next season. But there's also the idea that I don't know, you may be less likely to fight for or bond with your teammates if you think that they're not going to be around next season. This is it's obviously a problem with a lot of football league clubs that, you know, mainly probably teams are slightly smaller than Forest, but, you know, players generally don't sign longer than two, three-year contracts. So there isn't the kind of long-term thinking behind everything. And yeah, I'm always very reticent to kind of judge things, things like the mood of a squad from things like how annoyed they looked after the final whistle. Because it always calls to mind those kind of, you know, you see those newspaper pages after England get knocked out of tournaments where, you know, Raheem Sterling has cracked a smile or something like that, and the headline is Sterling laughs just hours after England's ignominious defeat or whatever it is. So it always seems a little bit ridiculous, and you kind of read into those things what you're already thinking. It's, you know, classic kind of confirmation bias kind of thing. But it must be incredibly difficult to have any kind of togetherness or team bonding in a situation like this. Paul spoke earlier on in the season about how the circumstances around just the circumstances around coronavirus, where players aren't able to socialise in the way that they usually would. Sam Allardyce has talked an awful lot about that coming in for West Brom. I mean, you know, he could be making excuses because they're terrible, but the things he usually does when he comes into a struggling team, you know, takes the players off on jollies somewhere, or team bonding exercises, or whatever it is, that this kind of weird old-fashioned alchemy that he does to improve struggling teams, he's just not been able to do this season. And that kind of feeds into one of the problems that Forest are having as well.
Jolly with Sam Allardyce does not bear thinking about. Right, there's no let up in the ferocity of Forest's forthcoming fixtures. High-flying Brentford next to test the Reds. We'll look ahead to that game next. So Forest visit the Brentford Community Stadium for the first time ever on Saturday as they take on Brentford in the Championship's early kickoff. It's live on Sky Sports if you're in the UK. Paul, let's start with some team news. Bree Samba and Joe Worrell both missed out against Norwich, as did Joe Lolley. And certainly for Lolley, it looks like it's a long-term problem.
Yeah, it's really sad for Joe. I think he'd admit himself that he's not quite reached the heights he's capable of consistently, at least this season. It's been a bit up and down for him. And he was just starting to show what he can do again. Even in the exact game where he got injured, he was starting to look bright and run at people and look like he meant business and could cause some damage. And it's a real blow for him to miss out for the rest of the season now. Perhaps I'm finding too much of a half full cup here, but I wonder if, you know, just having a bit of a break and being able to put his feet up between now and the end of the season and rest up, because he has got this I forget what it's called now, it's not quite shin splints, but he has got this compound muscle injury in his shins that has really hampered him. It hampered him at the end of last season and at the start of this one. He did have an injection to kind of cure it, and that helped a little bit, but you wonder if some rest might might help him get over that and be back to the Joe Lolly that we all know and love next season, hopefully. Beyond that, Anthony Knockhart and Samba, Chris Hughton said last night that both have got a chance of being back in the side this weekend, which would be a boost. Joe Worrell, you can't help but love Joe when you find out that he actually played at least one game with broken ribs before he finally mentioned it to somebody on the physio staff that he was in a bit of pain, and they checked it out and discovered that yes, he had got a cracked rib. So you'd never rule him, you know, maybe strapping himself up and getting back in the action this weekend. You never know with Joe, but certainly he'll be back after the international break, I would have thought.
He's very much modelling himself as a 2021 Stuart Pearce, I think, is Joe Worrell.
He's a throwback, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. On Joe Lolly, Nick, I wonder if not just a rest from physical exertion, but a mental break might do him some good too, because it looks like things have been weighing heavy on his mind as well as his hamstrings this season.
Yeah, and you get the impression that he is one of those players who does sort of not maybe takes things personally, is slightly too dramatic, but he certainly takes a lot of kind of pride in his own performances and the team's performances. Not, you know, obviously not that any other footballer doesn't, but to go from, I know we've been talking about how transient the squad is, but him being one of the longest serving players in the Forest squad, playing for Forest for that amount of time must, you know, the chaos in the club must kind of take its toll after a while, particularly in the, you know, a couple of seasons ago, he was maybe not Forest only attacking threat, but he certainly carried a lot of the sort of pressure and expectation. So there was the sort of psychological pressure to do with that. And then added to that, the pressure of trying to kind of find that form again. The idea that the team might be relying on you, particularly a team with as much expectation as the size of Forest, must be incredibly exhausting. So yeah, like you say, a few months to kind of clear his head and rest his legs and maybe have that have a bit of time for those shin problems that Paul was talking about to heal up a little bit more. So yeah, hopefully. At the moment, it feels like we're just constantly looking forward to next season, almost writing the kind of rest of the games off this season. But yeah, like the rest of the team, if he can be kind of mentally and physically fresh for next season, that's more important than him slogging through a few what will hopefully be quite meaningless games for the rest of the campaign.
In terms of Brentford, Paul, chucked away a 2-0 half-time lead at Derby in midweek to draw 2-2. Their form has been a little bit patchy of late, defeats at Coventry and QPR, amongst others. Is it potentially a good time to be playing them? I mean, maybe not a good time, but a better time to be playing them than when they were really firing a couple of months ago.
Yeah, possibly. And Forest do, you know, they seem to do better away from home lately as well. I don't know the precise home record off the top of my head, but I think it might only be one win in six or seven at home. But away from home, they seem to do a little bit better. Perhaps it's because, you know, they're a bit better suited to playing on the counter-attack, and in a similar way to Sabri Lamouchi's side, really. What worries me about Brentford is Tony. You know, Forest tend to, whenever an opposition striker is in good form or has scored a lot of goals that season, it somehow seems to be the way that he only ever adds to that tally when he faces Forest. We saw it with Pukki last night, and their main challenge this weekend is going to be to find a way to shackle Tony. He's a very, very good player at this level. What a signing he was. I think if Forest or any other Championship club for that matter could sign anybody this season, it'd be Peterborough Scouting Network, because whenever they lose a striker, they seem to find another one from somewhere who tends to be another world beater. You know, if you ever want a striker, I'd just start looking at Peterborough's squad and see who they've got, because it's just a seemingly a never-ending production line of very, very good Championship-level strikers. Forest actually could do with another striker this summer. That's one of the priorities they're going to have to address, I think. So maybe that'll be a good starting point for them.
And maybe they'd look at Brentford's recruitment policy as well, Nick. I mean, it's pretty controversial in that they don't have an academy per se. They have a B team, but in terms of the players they bring in, you know, they lost Benrahma and Watkins in the summer, but they had Tony in place to go. He scored 27 of their 64 league goals, which might suggest they're a little overly reliant on him. But there was a market for him last summer, and they just got in straight away and got him. And it's that kind of decisiveness which maybe Forest have lacked in recent years. Hi, Kamil Grzycki.
It's the decisiveness, and it's also the, particularly if you are a player in League One coming up to the Championship. Brentford are just a perfect team to play for because you know that the coaching is going to be good, the football is going to be good. They have a record of improving players that come in for the lower leagues, and then they have a record of selling them on those kind of players know very well that they're not going to be kept there against their will or anything like that. That is the kind of the way that that Brentford work. So even if, let's say, for the sake of argument, Forest, I believe Forest were sort of alerted to the possibility of signing Tony last summer and didn't really make much of a kind of particularly concerted effort to. Even if they did go and offer him more money than Brentford, if I was him, I would still have chosen Brentford just because you knew that was the smarter career move. You might get promoted with, you have more chance of getting promoted with Brentford. And if you didn't get promoted with Brentford, there was every chance that someone in the Premier League might sign you the following season, which, whether that's going to happen with Tony this season, we're not sure. Well, it would certainly take an awful lot of money to sign him, given that what Villa paid 27 million, something like that, for Ollie Watkins. But yeah, while it is frustrating that Forest weren't in the kind of in the market for Tony in particular, it's understandable that he would have chosen Brentford over someone like Forest.
In terms of the Forest team selection for this game, Paul, Munich and Madrid have tweeted to say, progress seems to have come to a halt following the derby draw. Seems to have moved away from the winning midfield formula of Cafu, Garner and Krivinovic that had us playing a lot quicker and actually showing some encouraging green shoots. Would you expect maybe go back to those three? And in particular, Garner seems to have become a really important player for Forest in a very short space of time.
Yes, he looks like a very good addition indeed. And of all the loan signings and players that are out of contract, if you had to pick one to sign for next season, it would be him straight away. You wouldn't even need to think twice about it, I don't think. He's been very good indeed. Krivinovic is the key to what has just been said there, I think. He started off, looked very bright, very neat and tidy, added some urgency and slickness to Forest play, but he did fade off a little bit. I could kind of understand why he was left out the side because he just dipped in standard a little bit. But if you can find a way to get him back to what he did during the early days of his loan spell, then absolutely having him back in the side could make a real difference, because that was arguably the best midfield trio that Forest have had in a while. Cafu and Garner seem to be a good blend. Cafu has a bit more dynamism than he perhaps gets credit for. He gets around the pitch. He's busy. He's not shy about putting a foot in if he has to. And, Krivinovic was just a really good link between midfield and attack, and just made Forest tick in a really understated way. So if they could get back to that little unit playing well and bringing the players around them into play, then yeah, that would be a great starting point for hopefully an improvement in form. I'd certainly be thinking about bringing Krivinovic back into the side this weekend and maybe giving Mighton that chance as well. I was a little bit surprised he didn't get brought on earlier than he did last night, but if you've got nothing to lose by giving him a chance, and I wouldn't understand why they wouldn't give him a run out just to see if he's the one that can provide that little bit of unpredictable creative spark. If you were an opposition side and you were up against Mighton and Amiobi down each side, you as a starting point, you wouldn't know what they were going to do. So that's a good place to be in if you're in a wayside.
Just on that midfield trio, I think it's possible that I might be to blame for that. I assume Chris Hutton listens to the pod and takes his kind of tactical tips from it. But yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I was heavily advocating for Ryan Yates to be found a place in that midfield somewhere, and that's happened in the last few games, and he's been pretty terrible. So my fault. Sorry about that, everyone.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see when Paul tweets the team news at 11:30 on Saturday, who's in and who's out. Just remember, guys, Paul doesn't pick the team.
No. Chris Hutton. Nor am I Ryan Yates' agent, by the way.
I can neither confirm or deny that.
somebody accused me of being rather closer friends with him than that last night as well. So, that was pleasant.
Good old Twitter. Right, next, some much-needed levity. Now, as Paul pointed out in his piece for The Athletic following the Reading game, Forest joint top scorer this season, joining Lyle Taylor on a whopping 4 goals, is a real OG. Home goals, that is. It's a shameful statistic, but it's one that gives us license to discuss some of the best own goals for and against the Reds in recent years. Nick, I'm sure that you thoroughly enjoyed having a look at this yesterday. Tell us some of the ones that you've come up with, please.
I did, yeah. Well, my favourite of the goals, own goals that I've been around for remains Gary Charles playing for Derby against Forest in 93.
Stone gets in. Here goes Collymore again, trying to get between the keeper and his defender short, who reacted coolly. Oh, and it's gone in! What a remarkable goal! Steve Stone will take the credit. That's a quite astonishing goal. Gary Charles against his old team kicks thin air, but he has helped, really, Forest forge a 2-goal lead here. It's an awful defensive error. Charles knows it as much as anybody.
It was one of the early beanbag games. Do you remember those, where they erected a big screen at City Ground and replayed the game as we sat in the executive stand? I mean, in latter years, I felt quite sorry for Gary Charles, because obviously that's pretty much the worst thing that can happen when you're playing for playing against an old team for their local rivals. But at the time, I found it unbelievably hilarious. this is one I didn't realise, actually. Probably one of the most crucial goals in Forest history was an own goal. In the last game of the 1976-77 season, Forest needed to beat Millwall to secure third place and promotion from the second division. Forest won 1-0 thanks to an own goal by a player called John Moore, who I had not heard of before this. It's been mentioned in a couple of places, though I found it quite difficult to verify it, that John Moore was actually voted Forest Player of the Year by some fans in probably the one of the local papers or something. Forest only won promotion by a single point that year, so if they'd have lost that game, then history might have been very, very different.
Yeah, in terms of ones that have gone in Forest's favour, not as significant, but also 1993 against Grimsby, a 5-3 win at the City Ground. Poor old Paul Futcher, credited with the own goal, simple back pass to his keeper, takes a massive air shot and in it trickles into the net. Just delightful stuff. Paul, have you got any for or against Forest?
You guys sort of went down the comedy and amusing route, and the one that stood out for me, there was the game earlier this season which kind of summed up everything that's good and bad about Forest at Stoke, when we could barely see what was happening all round. It ended up in a draw through two. I'm going to class one of them as an own goal because it felt like it should have been. It was Jordan Thompson. I had to write that down. He took the corner, and Lewis Graben had his infamous "I'm going to duck under this ball" moment, and the ball went in off Bree Samba, and then somewhere between the threads of fog and mist, Anthony Knockhart swung in across, and James Chester converted to give Forest a point. And they'd created chance after chance in that game and should have scored, didn't score, and ultimately had to rely on an own goal, which is exactly why Forest are in the situation they are in this season, you know, with own goals threatening to be their top scorer. Beyond that, the one that stood out, and I feel bad for mentioning it because it was the moment that Forest's season deteriorated last season, was Nuno Da Costa. Poor old Nuno chased all the way back, final day against Stoke City, bust a gut to get back and try and prevent the goal and end up putting it in his own net. And that was the moment that the season finally went down the shitter, to be frank. So, yes. That a painful memory, but one that stood out, unfortunately. And, you know, poor old Nuno, that was the only goal he ever scored for Forest, wasn't it? So off he popped.
It's a quiz question for the next Athletic Forest quiz, I'm sure. I've forgotten that Nicholas Bentner scored an own goal at Derby for Forest, which was the only goal of the game in 2016. Plenty of people mentioning Des Walker as well, obviously FA Cup final 91 and the playoff semi-final in 2003. I'll always have a lot of love for Terry Wilson roofing one, yes, at the City Ground against Sheffield Wednesday back in 89. But maybe, Nick, the gold standard here is Mark Crossley at Ewood Park.
Things couldn't get much worse for Forest. Oh yes, they could, from Colin Henry's header. Crossley, own goal. For goalkeepers, there really is nowhere to hide.
Classic kind of slippery hands norm era. if for whatever reason you listeners are too young to remember this, first season that Forest got relegated, 92-93, playing Blackburn, Crossley caught a cross, I think it was, or saved a shot, gathered it into his stomach, rolled over, and the ball squirted into the net. It was one of those where the most amusing thing about it was the crowd reaction, because it was at Ewood Park, so there was a sort of the ooh and the slight deflation as they thought Blackburn's attack had failed, and then the kind of slight confusion as everyone tried to work out what had gone on. As I recall, the Forest defenders were all kind of on their way out of the penalty area, kind of going, okay, we've done our jobs for this attack. Norm's got the ball. Let's take our positions for the counter attack. And then they all turn around to see the ball kind of gently nestling in the back of the net. So yeah, in terms of own goals, kind of scored against Forest by Forest players, the traumatic goal standard is, of course, both of those by Des Walker, but the other one was Alan Wright in the 2007 playoff semi-final against Yeovil. Because I am so dedicated to this pod / hate myself, I watched the highlights of that earlier on before we were recording this. I think I'd sort of mentally blocked out in my mind that Forest were 3-1 up on aggregate with 9 minutes left, and at that point everything that possibly could go wrong did go wrong. Alan Wright, it was a shot from outside the box that hit the post and then hit, I think, the back of Alan Wright's head.
Was he injured at that point, or was that afterwards?
And that was afterwards. He got injured in extra time. So yeah, then the ball trickled in, and that was 2-1. Yeovil equalised. I'm not sure which way around this was. I think it was just after they equalised that David Prutton got sent off. And then, having made all substitutions with 10 men in extra time, Alan Wright did his hamstring, I think, and was just kind of left hobbling around in the place of the part of the pitch where he could do the least damage. And it all started from that own goal by Alan Wright. Great memories.
There you go. I didn't want to delve into the misery too much. I feel like I ought to have done more of misery hunting.
No, well, as I said, Paul, I was kind of hoping that this would bring us a bit of light-hearted relief, but then
apparently not.
Yeovil, and now I feel worse than ever.
Sorry.
The Bender one was the interesting one, wasn't it? Because he almost scored 2 own goals in that one. After he'd scored the first one, he then rattled the bar with another effort. It was like he forgot which end he was attacking.
Anyway, speaking of Nicholas Bentner, we're on the home stretch for this podcast, but you better believe there's still time for a quiz. Yes, it's Did They Really Play for Forest? Over to our quiz master, Nick Miller, who will explain how this feature works.
So this is a famous footballer who had a brief / not very memorable spell at Nottingham Forest. 5 clues in kind of ascending level of, or descending, sorry, level of difficulty. I will warn you that this is hard this week. I will be...
Oh, yeah, and they're normally so easy.
I was going to say, if Nick's saying that, we are bang in trouble.
I will be impressed if you get this, just in general, I think, but certainly before the fourth or fifth clue. Anyway, okay.
I used to like you, Nick. I hope you know that.
You can dislike me for the next 5 minutes and then after.
Oh, I will.
Okay, first clue. The manager who gave me my senior debut was Ozzy Ardiles.
Okay. Right, yeah. Paul, have you got anything?
Nope.
I know he didn't play for Forest, but I'm going to say it anyway because I think it's always better when there's a guess for every question. Stuart Nethercott.
No, it's not Stuart.
Very satisfying name to say, isn't it?
Really is, yeah.
Nethercott.
Although it does sort of, if you weren't a Forest fan and someone said, did Stuart Nethercott play for Forest? You'd probably go, yeah, probably at some point, yeah. Okay, clue number 2. My Forest career was relatively brief. I spent just over 2 months online at Forest during Paul Hart's first season, sharing the pitch with your Gareth Williamses, your Jim Brennans, and your David Bruttons.
Okay. First thought was Nicky Shorey, but that was Billy Davis, so it's a long time before then.
Just before my era. There was literally the...
Oh. Who did we have on loan in that sort of 02 to 04 period? Wouldn't be him because he wouldn't have been given his debut by Ozzy Ardiles.
Just to give everyone a little peek behind the curtains here, we have recently switched to using a popular video conferencing software to record this on, whereas previously it was just audio. So I really am enjoying seeing the despairing faces of Matt and Paul as opposed to just the deathly and confused silence when we're trying to figure out these clues.
Paul, I know we're not really supposed to help each other, but I'm just fixating on Spurs players because of Ozzy Ardiles. I'm trying to remember, has he managed anybody else in England, Ozzy Ardiles?
That's literally what I was racking myself to think. I don't think he has, has he?
No, I don't think so.
I'm trying to judge Nick's face now. Where is he?
Okay, let's have the next clue. Unless you've got a guess, Paul.
Have you seen my face?
Come on then, clue number three. I think if you get it here, there's still some respectability.
Okay, clue number three. I scored a penalty in that 1998 playoff final between Charlton and Sunderland.
Okay, right.
Oh, God.
Michael Gray famously missed the penalty in that shootout. He was playing for Sunderland at that time. Not Quinn and Phillips, wouldn't have been. He never played for Mendonca was the one that I thought of because he get a hat trick in that final maybe? Says Stalling and Stalling.
I can picture like seven of the players who scored. I don't think it's any of them.
Yeah, I just can't stop thinking about Richard Rufus, which is not the right answer. So I'm gonna stay away from him. Carl Tyler played for Charlton as well, didn't he? But he never played for Ozzy Ardiles. I don't know, do you, Paul?
It wasn't Nigel Quashie. He wasn't a loan signing, was he?
No.
No. And also didn't play in that Charlton Sunderland game.
Well, there are only two minor flaws in that game. Come on. Big show.
Oh, all right. It's getting spiky now. Jesus.
All right, so clue number four, please.
Clue number four. After leaving my first club, I signed for the club at which my father was a club hero, where I played under Frank Clark.
Ooh, okay. I've got a guess.
You've got it, haven't you? You've done me.
I'm not sure if I've got it, but I think it's somebody who I absolutely loved when he was on loan at Forest. I thought he was brilliant for us for that brief period. Is it Nicky Summerby?
It is Nicky Summerby.
Yes!
Yes, well done. Well done indeed, Matt.
Did he play for Spurs then?
No, Swindon.
Oh, he managed Swindon, didn't he? He took him up, I think.
Yes. He didn't. Glenn Hoddle took him up to the Premier League, but Ozzy Ardiles was just before that.
Right. Okay. Good.
Knowing the answer now, do you want to have a go at what the fifth clue might have been?
Oh no.
Go on, then. The fifth clue was going to be: I am still an extremely unpopular figure at Coventry after ending the career of Steve Froggatt with what we're obliged to call a horror tackle. I scored one of my two goals for Forest against Coventry, giving it the big one to their booing fans, and then I got sent off.
I don't remember that. Yeah. He was good though, wasn't he? Do you remember watching him, Nick?
I particularly remember that game against Coventry because I think he scored a free kick from quite a long way out at the Trent end and ran kind of pseudo Adebayor style towards the Coventry fans to kind of quite distastefully, I suppose, give it the big one to them after they were, you know, booing him for his crippling of Steve Froggatt before. Then about 10 minutes later, got himself sent off, which kind of rather proved their point, I suppose.
Right, that's just about it for this week. Before we go, let's see what the chaps have got lined up for Athletic subscribers to enjoy. Paul, how about you?
I have finally almost got to the point where I'm going to speak to the...
This is a look into the journalistic process, listener. This is how it works. This is exactly how it works.
Yes, the feature on the Ripped Jean and Luminous Trainered Polish Wizard is on the horizon. There's also a piece about another... I guess you would almost call him a cult hero of the Billy Davis era as well. There's going to be another piece on him on the horizon as well. And of course, I get to go to Brentford. It's a bit hard to fit stuff in around the flurry of fixtures that Forest have. Hopefully, we'll get some more interesting stuff in the bag during the international break. But yeah, hoping to pin down the ripped jeans. I'm going to ask him as well if he still wears ripped jeans and a leather jacket, because that'd be glorious if he does.
Are you not giving us his name because you're teasing it, or do you think that we know it?
No, I'm sure you know. There's only one Polish wizard, isn't it?
It's Radoslav Majewski. Yeah, I love that little guy. I really did. So you're going to Brentford, Paul. Is this going to be the first time you've been to a new stadium in a long time, presumably?
It will be. But bizarrely, just with perfect timing, before the lockdown began, I'd started on the process of finishing the whole set of clubs, because there's only three or four left for me to do, and the lockdown has somewhat put the kibosh on that. But Brentford have kindly added another one to the list, which I'll get to to tick off. The best thing about Brentford, or should I say the worst thing, is that the old ground, the press box was the tightest press box you've ever known. If you're the bigger than the size of a munchkin, there was no way you were getting in it without, you know, they used to serve these lovely pre-match pies and sausage rolls in the press room. If you had one too many of those, you weren't sitting down for the match. You just weren't getting in the press box. So hopefully the new facilities will involve a man-sized press box that can accommodate my gut without any kind of, you know, agonizing pain midway through the second half.
Yeah, it's just a shame they don't have the pubs on every corner as they used to. That was good. Nick, I'm sure there's an athletic long read in tight press boxes, but you haven't been working on that. What have you been working on?
Well, funny you should mention that. No, I haven't. I am kind of working on at the early stages of a kind of wide range of projects that could go wrong between when they're supposed to be published now, so I won't try anything specifically. I will instead direct you towards something that has nothing to do with Forest that I've only had tangential involvement in, which was a couple of the very popular Galazzo podcasts, which are about the history of Italian football, presented by James Richardson, James Horncastle and Gab Marcotti. The last one that they did was about Ronaldo, or Phenomenal Ronaldo's years at Inter. Which was for chaps like of my age that I will never tire of hearing tales of Brazilian Ronaldo. So I thoroughly recommend that.
Yeah, and it can only be a matter of time before Paul goes on that pod to discuss Roberto Baggio's move to Forest and why that didn't come about. By the way, listener, if you subscribe to The Athletic now, you can do so for a special price of $3.99 a month for 6 months. That's 40% off the price of a full subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. So go to theathletic.com/forestpod to take advantage of this special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/forestpod. That's just about it for this week. Do join us again same time next week. For now, though, from myself, from Nick, from Paul, and from producer AD, thanks for joining us today. We'll catch up with you again soon.
The Athletic.